You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Max Strang. Max, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Max, let's talk about the practice of Strang architecture. I know are you in Miami now? Is that where you're talking from?
Well, I'm actually talking to you from Sarasota, Florida, right now on Florida's Gulf Coast. But our firm is headquartered in Miami.
So let's talk about a project that you're working on now, and then we'll get into perhaps the approach of the firm and can discuss things in more specifics, you know, especially the climate-driven designs you're known for. What is it that your firm is currently involved in? I imagine it's more than one thing.
It is. We have quite a variety of projects going on right now. Most of our work is in the single-family residential, but we've used that to get into more of the hospitality market. And, you know, I tell people that I'll design a sewage treatment plant as long as it's going to be interesting, you know?
Right. And so right now you're doing single family residences. Is that a current project?
Correct. We've got about 40 of them underway at some stage right now. The bulk of our work is indeed in South Florida. But we have some other work scattered across the Caribbean, the Bahamas, you know, Dominican Republic, and one as far away as Dubai. But without a doubt, you know, Florida is our main place of practice. We have offices in Miami, in Fort Lauderdale, and more recently in Sarasota, where I'm speaking to you from right now.
So let's talk about one of these projects as it might articulate what's been, a cumulative practice over these years about climate-driven design, and also, you know, there's also your relationship to modernism, because just to talk about that a little bit, you grew up in a modernist home, is that correct?
I did, and that probably is what spurred me on to become an architect later in life. You know, there is a movement in the 1950s and 60s in Sarasota that was spearheaded by Paul Rudolph. So appropriately enough that I'm talking to Yale Radio. But Paul Rudolph, his early work was here in Sarasota. And he and a bunch of 20-something young architects were creating some really progressive work here in Sarasota. And the house I grew up in was designed by an architect named Gene Leedy, who was one of these Sarasota school architects. And so for me, I think, you know, that has made the residential aspect, the residential sector has always been a real close part to my heart, and probably explains why we do so much of it right now.
So let's talk a little bit about your home, and it is interesting about Rudolph, right? He's done the Yale Architecture Building here that's recently been renovated. Mm-hmm. It looks quite gorgeous. What was the home that you grew up in look like? I mean, if it's drawing from him, if it's that school, was it also a lot of cement, or how was that built?
You know, it's funny. I would say that Paul Rudolph's early work, along with many of these Sarasota school architects, it was very light and delicate, you know, some real, I mean, there were smaller commissions, but I think they're lauded just for how delicate and lightly they rested on the ground. And, you know, as the commissions came in over time, they got bigger and more complex, but all of the architects, Rudolph included, you know, got more into the concrete and more bold and substantial buildings and design. Yeah, eventually that led into the whole brutalism side of things, but the early work in Sarasota was indeed very light. The house that I grew up in is actually in Winter Haven, Florida, the center part of the state, and that was, I was born in 70, so the house was completed in about 68, 69, and it was indeed one of those heavier structures. It was Gene Leedy designed a house that was built of this pre-stressed concrete double T's and a lot of exposed concrete block and glass walls. So it was in, it was a remarkably progressive building for its time. I would say it still is. And as a young child growing up around this, you know, all this raw concrete, it really had an effect on me.
Well, also your parents obviously were sensitive to that, and I would imagine talking about the aesthetics of that as well, besides the building itself, I would imagine their relationship to it was also important to you.
It was, and the building itself, it was a courtyard design with breezeways and balconies and deeply shaded areas, and it was not designed in a time that was before air conditioning, but it was certainly designed in a time when air conditioning was cheap and oil was cheap. Over time, my parents actually started relying less on the AC and kind of going back to opening up all of the sliding glass doors and using the breezeways and the house itself. You know, the way the air just went through it, it was always a pretty delightful and comfortable place to be.
It sounds so exciting. It sounds a little dreamy in a way. I mean, I'm not an architect, but I'd love to grow up in a house like that. I grew up in a, you know, kind of Victorian house in Westchester with small rooms. And lately I went and looked back at my house, you know, through Google Maps, and the whole house was much smaller than I even remembered it. And so kind of boxy as opposed to the kind of beautiful open spaces that sound like you grew up in, which is in a way a whole different way of living.
And yeah, and these homes in Florida and modern architecture in Florida in general was all about opening up the house to the climate because for most of the year we could. And we still can, although many people just forget that and they prefer to live in a little air-conditioned box. But the focus of a lot of our projects are how can we, not just bring the outdoors in, but create environments within the home or adjacent to the home that are outdoors and are immersive environments that the homeowners want to spend most of their time. And I think when you look at the bulk of our work, you can see that we put as much emphasis on the outdoor spaces as we do on the interior spaces.
So let's talk about one of your projects as a way of kind of walking through that and talking about the way you work. Maybe that could be the Shokum Education Center, or is there a home or something else that you think is one of your favorite projects that we could discuss?
Yeah, in fact, let's talk two. The first one, I'm going to go back, was a house that I completed for myself and my young family in 2004. And that was in Coconut Grove, which is a part of Miami that is it actually predated the city of Miami, but it's more of a jungle. You know, it's not the beach and the palm trees you might come to expect when you think of Miami. This is it's just a immense tree canopy, and it felt like a jungle. And actually, the house that I'm referring to, we called it the Rock House, but it was in the movie that Michael Mann, the producer Michael Mann, created of Miami Vice, and it. The house was the jungle lair of a South American drug lord, because it was, and I think that will help underscore how just extra tropical, if you will, that this particular neighborhood in Coconut Grove was. That, you know, through Hollywood special effects, they thought that it could easily be perceived as being, you know, next to the equator. But, this was a house that drew heavily on some of the Paul Rudolph and Sarasota School inspirations. One of Paul Rudolph's most famous houses was in Sarasota called the Umbrella House. And basically, it was a small little home that had this wood sunscreen on top of the house that basically served as an umbrella and a cooling device for the whole house. And it was very structurally expressive, and I think many would say that's one of his best works of architecture. So when it came to designing this particular house that I'm talking about, we put an umbrella on top of it as well. However, what was different is we kind of raised the umbrella a little further above the house that could create a occupiable roof deck you know, along that the entire stretch of the house. So it's a pretty unique way of being able to experience the tropics and the climate and the site that South Florida had to offer.
And you also use a lot of stone in that house around the entrances, right? Was that something mm-hmm. that was part of that, that school that you're talking about, the Sarasota School? Because that doesn't seem familiar to me, although I don't know the Sarasota School that well, but your use of stone seems unusual and also seems like it would be fitting of a drug lord, you know, as you mentioned. That,
yeah.
You know, has well, kind of a, I don't know, a feeling of almost... of antiquity, you know, for lack of a better word. It has that feeling of something that's been around for ages, but not at all a sense of kind of brutalism in other structures.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of, I guess, where it departs from the Sarah School a little bit and goes more into the context of, you know, our local site there in Miami. Coconut Grove actually is one of the highest parts in the entire county, you know, at a whopping 18 feet above sea level. That's going to come in handy soon, but Coconut Grove is built on this ridge of what was called oolitic limestone or oolite, and you know you dig 2 inches in the ground and you hit this rock, and it's the bedrock of Miami. And so, in fact, when we excavated part of the foundations for our house, we used that stone to clad the home. So that's why you know it was locally sourced, and we took it from the ground and put it right on the house, and it really connected it to the specific site there in Coconut Grove.
And in terms of its relationship to the climate, I know we're going to talk about one other project of yours, but was your house also, I mean, there's the open-air deck and the spaces inside. Did it also begin your firm's pursuit of what it means to be, I guess, you know, sensitive to the climate itself, to be a climate-driven design, so to speak?
I would say so. I think just, you know, my early exposure to all that kind of great Florida mid-century architecture that, you know, relied on all of the passive environmental techniques and airflow and shade and all that stuff. It's kind of baked into my way of thinking. You know, a lot of our houses and projects, they're really just long and skinny for reasons that on a long, skinny building, you can get a lot more cross ventilation, you can get a lot more natural light into the building. So yeah, I think that early exposure allowed me to draw on these concepts and, you know, advance them into this new era. You know, we're not trying to replicate things from the past. We're trying to take those ideas, we're trying to take those ideas and make them more appropriate for today and put new technologies on top of them.
So let's talk about the other project you wanted to mention. There's your home, and what was the other one we're going to discuss?
Okay, well, this is a home that I have in the works right now, also in Miami. And the reason I'm bringing this one in is because the lowest floor of the home is going to be 22 feet above the existing grade, and the sea level rise conversation is, you know, much more prevalent in Miami as it is in the rest of Florida. They really are on the front lines. You know, there's so much at stake, and we are already having our clients. You know, one was in the New York Times about 6 or 8 months ago and addressing this issue. And, you know, this one particular house required $500,000 worth of dirt and seawalls to bring up the site, just another 18 to 24 inches. So we're already starting to raise the ground, or at least I would say the private sector is, to raise the ground in advance of what's coming. And, you know, before the waters rise, it's going to be the insurance companies and the banks that are going to be paying close attention to what the height levels are. But aside from the ground, we now have clients that are wanting their lowest floor of their house to be, you know, substantially higher above ground than what the code minimums currently dictate.
And this is all because of sea levels rising, of course, which is part of what you're preparing for. But I would imagine there's other issues too, such as, I don't know if they're using wells there, but well water could also be compromised by rising sea levels as well, right?
Yeah. The whole aquifer underneath South Florida is that, it's at a critical state right now because of the inundation from saltwater underneath. Remember, underneath Miami, it's a porous limestone, right? So our drinking water is actually interspersed with the rock itself because it's so porous. It's like rivers flowing underground. So the seawater, the salty seawater, can intrude onto those freshwater aquifers, and that's already starting to happen. Not to mention the other issues, like, half of Miami-Dade County is on septic drain fields, not a sewer system. And you probably in 10 years or so, you're going to start to see a lot of those septic drain fields failing because, there's not enough room between the ground level and the water level underneath for those things to operate. So it's going to be a messy problem.
Oh, that's an understatement, right? It sounds terrifying, really. I try not to get too scared about all that, but it sounds just terrifying, the idea of, because there isn't an easy solution to that. It could be the displacement of millions of people as well, not simply like what's a fix for Miami-Dade? There isn't really one for that. There's, right? I mean, you're preparing for a future in a number of levels, but there's some things that there isn't a fix for, I would think.
Well, if you look long-term in Miami, let's say that, in 100 years, the water's up 6 or 8 feet. I think that's a reasonable expectation now based on a lot of different studies you're hearing. It's going to be a dramatically different landscape or waterscape, I would add. But we know how to do these things. We know how to raise, buildings. The private sector knows how to do it. The public sector, the roads, the infrastructure, the water, the sewer, that stuff's going to be tricky, and it's unfortunately politicized as well. But, our governor currently, Rick Scott, he's, making it hard when a local government such as Miami Beach has an intersection of a local road that they want to raise with a state road that you're not allowed to talk about raising stuff. It's tricky. It's making that trickier. But from the private sector, be it a homeowner or a commercial property, they're already getting. They're starting to get the word that it's going to be better. There's going to be financial incentives for them to raise their property and their buildings now. And for architects and designers, there's going to be some new opportunities there, when it comes to the simple aspect of a home. If we need to be raising these homes higher up off the ground, there's going to be opportunities to design those spaces underneath the house in some clever and usable ways. And I think, those could be places of enjoyment underneath the homes. We need to work with the building officials and certain, code writers to make sure that, we do it correctly, but I think there's some opportunity there as well.
That is exciting then, in terms of how you're looking at the future. But before I ask you the last question, is there something else you want to add to that last project or about your practice that I haven't answered or you'd like to mention?
Sure. There's you mentioned, the displacement of large populations as a result of sea level rise. And I just co-taught a course at the University of Florida last semester, and we focused on the rapid densification of Florida's inland cities due to people from the coast citing that, it's either too expensive or they don't want to live through an ongoing public works project. There's some attractive places in the middle of the state, that people will move to. And there's also, aside from people moving from the coast to the middle, there's still going to be people up in the Northeast, with a brutal winter like this past one and 4 nor'easters in a row, Florida's still going to be attractive from a climate standpoint. And I think a lot of those people moving to Florida from the north, a lot of them are going to elect not to live on the coast. A lot of them will elect to live in these smaller towns, many of which you've never heard of. But we're working with some of these small towns, Winter Haven, for instance, that can start preparing now to receive this large influx. And, They're open.
Max, I'm so glad we talked about this. I want to ask you one more question, which is a bit off topic, but what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I just got back from spring break, so I was in the Bahamas reading some more. I thought it was escapist stuff, but there's a book called Red Notice about some of the Magnitsky Act stuff in Moscow, and just pretty much how terrible the Russians are behaving these days. That was a page turner.
Yeah, I guess that is escapist in a dramatic way, but also, unfortunately, it's real as well. Max, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.